Welcome to another edition of the Rooster Crows podcast. My name is Reverend Stephen Milton, and today we're going to be talking about a kind of new idea about how to deal with homelessness. It's been so frustrating watching the city of Toronto suffer rising rates of homelessness and all the same answers always being provided. Either we need more shelters or we need more income supplements, all of which are good ideas and necessary, but they don't seem to solve all of the problems. And this summer, I was at a deputation at City Hall, where I was giving my support for six new shelters in neighborhoods outside the downtown core. And I watched as representatives from an organization called Two Steps Home provided a series of presentations about their idea for bringing tiny homes into the city of Toronto. This has been tried in small ways before, but this is a sustained effort to try and create communities of some 50 people in tiny homes in Toronto as a way of solving the encampment crisis. And to get into this, I had a really terrific conversation with Robert Rayner, who is an architect who's been working with an organization in Toronto called Two Steps Home. And that's what today's podcast is about, our conversation. And so I hope that by the end of this, you will feel that there is hope and that there are more possibilities than you thought there were before in terms of how to help people escape homelessness in Toronto. Here's the interview.
My name's Robert Rayner. I'm one of the directors of Two Steps Home, which is a not-for-profit in Toronto. Working to build tiny home communities as a response to homelessness.
Okay. And what sort of background do you bring to this?
So my background, I come from the world of architecture. I'd finished my master's of architecture at University of Toronto several years back. One of my thesis projects there was on innovative alternative forms of shelter as a response to the a broken housing continuum. And so that's, you know, among other things, kind of led me to this role.
Awesome. Can you talk a little bit about why you think it's broken? Like, what's wrong with the way the system works now when someone ends up homeless?
Yeah, well, typically what happens when someone ends up out on the street is one of a couple of things. You know, if they're out for just a short amount of time, they're able to bunk with a friend. They're able to get back on their feet, perhaps, and those situations are great. You know, someone kind of falls into this. It's if you think of this as the edge of a cliff. You know, and you think of the edge of that cliff being kind of a poverty line. You know, effectively, once someone falls off that poverty line, kind of off of this cliff into water below, that water is homelessness. If you're there for a short amount of time. You're there for a couple days, a week, and someone's able to reach in and give you a helping hand up. That's great. But the longer you're in there, the more you kind of are swept away into the waters, the more challenging it is to stay afloat, the more tired you get, the harder it is to be able to carry on. And then the situation worsens and it takes a lot more to pull someone out once they've been in for a long time. So typically with the shelter system these days, once someone is on the street and in the shelter, it's kind of on them to pull themselves back out of the water. The current system we have is effectively says, here's a dinghy where you can float in the water. That's the shelter system. But there's no rope on the dinghy to pull you to shore. You know, these are you're staying out there. Your physiological needs are arguably being met. You know, you have your shelter, you have some access to food, usually access to water and showers and those things if you're in the shelter. But there aren't really ways that you can kind of pull yourself back up. If you're, let's say you're looking to go for a job interview, you need to be able to wait in a long line for a shower if there is one. You know, you need to have clean clothes, you need to have a place to wash your clothes, you need to have a place to store your clothes, like the most basic things that allow us to function in our daily lives and kind of improve our lives and get to where we want to be. You're lacking those. And so really, I think an issue that we face as a society is that we talk about wanting to, deal with homelessness, but we're not actually providing the opportunities for people who are homeless to end their homelessness or to move on to the next phase of their lives. And then we complain about the fact that homelessness remains, you know, when there isn't that pathway to move forward. And so the goal really should be, how do we allow people to move forward from this rather than simply hold them while they continue to experience it?
Yeah, that's a really good point. I've done interviews on this podcast earlier with street nurses and other people who have talked about how the longer you live on the street, the harder it is to climb back out. And I love your metaphor of being lost in the water. And one of the things people don't realize is that, you know, yes, it's true that there's homeless people or people experiencing homelessness who are substance users. And there's people with mental health problems, but we don't recognize that the experience of being homeless can bring on those conditions. You know, as people self-medicate, they know that they're considered the bottom of the barrel and basically they're rejected by society. And so it's very easy to become deeply depressed and turn to substances to try and just get yourself through the day and mask some of the trauma of being homeless, as well as possibly trauma from whatever, you know, sparked your homelessness crisis in the first place. You know, some people are just kicked out of their places. They had no issues. Other people had some issues, and, you know, poverty exacerbated that and they ended up on the street. So,
100%. You know, we're all one step away from being homeless. You know, and I think that's a thing that too many people don't quite recognize. And something too that, you know, once you're in that situation, you know, I remember thinking to myself several years back, like, if homelessness ever it becomes, if I ever find myself, you know, lacking a place to live, I want supports for myself. I want to be able to know that I'm going to be okay and weather that storm. If that storm comes to me, that storm comes to my friends. And of course, you know, but this should be the baseline for everyone in our society.
absolutely. And we, you know, our city, our province, our country has signed all sorts of declarations that say that housing is a human right, and yet we don't really follow through on that. Now, I guess there's two populations of homeless people. There's those who end up in the shelters inside, but there's also people who decide to live outside or are forced to live outside. Like we're speaking in Toronto, so that means for some people, sleeping in ATM kiosks, but also a lot more people sleeping in the ravines and sleeping in encampments. Can you talk about the difference between those populations, the people who sleep inside and the people who sleep outside?
I think one of the primary differences between folks who are living, you know, using the shelter system and those who are outside, ultimately it's, you know, it's the same population of people. And a lot of times the folks who are living in encampments and choosing to stay outside and not use the shelter system are those who have used it and have experienced had negative experiences in shelter. No, there's kind of a separate population of folks who simply don't have access. You know, whether it's you know, having the shelter system has a 2-bag limit, you know, and so you're allowed to carry 2 bags worth of all of your worldly possessions, and if you have more than that, you either store them somewhere, in which case, you know, that's great, you're able to, or you hide it behind a bench somewhere, and that's littering, and there's a bylaw against that, and your things will be taken away. So, you know, very kind of basic, or pets, having a pet is another one. Not all shelters allow you to bring a dog with you or you know, whatever pet. And so of course, if you know, have your pet and your pet is a such an integral part of your, you know, life and a thing that brings you purpose and joy and love and care, you're not going to want to give up that experience or have to find somewhere for your pet to go in order to use this, certainly not for a long term. So I think there are the people who use the shelter system, or rather, I think there are the people who don't use the shelter system because they are not that they find barriers to access. There are the people who don't use the shelter system because they have already used it before, and don't have had negative experiences and feel that they can avoid those by not using it. And there are the people who attempt to use the shelter system and find that on a given night it's full. And so, you know, currently in Toronto, like our numbers kind of hover between 95 and 100% of capacity at a given time. And often, you know, the discrepancy there, those extra 2% is not that everyone who needs it has used it and we just happen to have like three extra beds. It's more like, you know, a bed was held for someone at the other end of the city. That person made a call to the central intake system, which is the system through which you gain access to the shelter, and someone says, you know, well, we've got a shelter up at Yonge and Eglinton, and you may be in Etobicoke, and you might not have a Presto card that has funds on it. You may it's challenging to navigate there. You might have a cell phone that's died, and you Google Maps has kind of become the de facto way in which a lot of people navigate the city. And just the most basic things kind of keeping you from getting there. If that bed's not filled by, you know, 1, 2 o'clock in the morning, it will be considered an unfilled bed, and therefore the capacity numbers don't reach full. So by and large, Toronto has an at capacity shelter system, and there are thousands of people who stay outside every night as a result of that, and as a result of the other reasons that we've talked about.
Right, and I guess there's recently been released a census of people who live on the street, right? The Street Needs Assessment Report, and it said that, you know, about 10% of all people who are homeless, or at least on one night in October of 2024, were living outside. And I think in previous reports they've shown that the folks who live outside are a little different than the folks who live inside. They're less likely to be refugees. They're more likely to be indigenous. They're more likely to have lived outside a long time, and often were people who became homeless as teenagers. Sort of, you know, hardcore people, right? So a different kind of population who will not go back, a lot of them will not go back into the shelter system because of all those negative experiences you've talked about. So how do we help them? I mean, your organization, Two Steps Home, is really focused on people living in encampments and people living outside and trying to provide an alternative to them. So what is the alternative that you present?
To kind of work out what that alternative is, one of the initial things that we did was talk with folks who are living in several encampments. We've done this off and on over several years. And what we've heard is that with a lot of folks, you know, when you enter the shelter system, certain needs are met. You know, you have shelter, right? You have warmth in the winter, you have, you know, some level of cool in the summer. You have access to water. You may have access to food, depending on the services that are available. But often you're either in a small room or you're in a, you know, on a cot in a grid of dozens of people. And so you don't quite have the ability to keep your belongings safe in the same way that you would elsewhere. Oftentimes, when you're lining up at different places or getting a spot in different shelters at different times of the day, or different days of the week, you're dealing with the fact that you're not seeing the same people over and over again. You know, it's a different group who comes in. And so you're not necessarily able to kind of form those bonds that you would otherwise form. You don't aren't able to see the same people kind of, you know, over and over again. And you don't necessarily have any real personal agency. You know, you have to line up at a certain time. You have to go to bed at a certain time. You have to get up at a certain time, leave by a certain time. You know, the food comes, like food is provided to you perhaps, and you take what's given. You don't have any real opportunity to kind of curate a space to be yours. You know, so very, very basic esteem needs and very basic, you know, needs of belonging are lacking, you know, in these circumstances. And these are things that are particularly fat, like well found in encampments. You know, folks, when someone puts up a tent, like that is their space. You know, when you see the people around you who have tents set up as well, you start to get to know these people. These people have your back, you have their back. And that's both from a, you know, to some degree from a medical perspective, and also to some degree of, you know, seeing, oh, someone went into, you know, oh, someone went into Robert's tent. I'm gonna go make sure that they're not stealing something of his. You know, there becomes a respect and a reliance on one another, which is such a basic fundamental, you know, part of being human that you simply don't get in the shelter system. It's the ability to benefit from and contribute back to your community. And so I think a lot of you know what we've seen is that people who are in the shelter system aren't able to do that, and being outdoors, having a little more agency, having that ability to do that, there are other needs that are not being met there, but the belief is that these are more important needs in a given time. And so what we are really looking to do is try to create an option for folks that provides both the, you know, physiological needs of the shelter system with those kind of belonging and esteem needs that you find in encampments and sense of community that you find in encampments, and try to create something that's desirable for folks in encampments to go to, something that is a step up and is, in their eyes, an improvement over the encampments that are already existing. And we believe that tiny home communities are that thing.
Okay, so maybe you could unpack what is a tiny home. I mean, the name seems pretty obvious, but I think people probably say, well, okay, so it's a house that it's really, really small. How many people can fit into it, and does it have indoor plumbing? Like, how does this work?
For sure. So what we're looking to do is build communities of 30 to 50 tiny homes on vacant plots of land, and have a central modular building as well that can support 24/7 services. So all of the supportive services that a person would need, and that these would be temporary communities. So I'll start with the tiny homes themselves. We call them cabins. These are 8 foot by 12 foot small sleeping quarters. There's space for a bed, there's space for a desk, a dresser, you know, anything that's yours. It's a small room, basically a bedroom. Each unit would have electricity coming to it, and so it has, you know, power outlets, it has lighting and all of that. Otherwise, it's actually very, we have a prototype that we've built, and it's very well affixed. You know, there's a lot of it's well made. There's no plumbing to each individual unit. This is just a bedroom, and so the central building on site would have, you know, the washrooms, would have a dining room, would have a kitchen, would have showers, would have laundry, would have all of the services that someone would need, and then also have, you know, medical spaces, also have community spaces. So the places where 24/7 wraparound services would be able to come. So, you know, we're talking about maybe a legal clinic is able to come to the site once a week if someone, you know, to help folks be able to get the papers that they need to apply for work in certain places. It's a very specific example, but, you know, whether that's just a health truck being able to come to the site and somewhere where folks can set up for wound care, for all the things that people who have lived outdoors or in the shelter system for a long time have to deal with.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point, which people don't always appreciate, is that if you've been living on the streets for, like, say, a year or so, you get behind in things. You know, your health care, you get behind on. You haven't been going to the dentist, you haven't seen a doctor, you may not have paid your taxes in a year or two. And that becomes a really huge hurdle, because even if you get a grant like the COB grant, the Canada Ontario Housing Benefit, even if you get the COB grant so that you can afford an apartment, no landlord's going to take you unless they see that you're up to date on your taxes. So it's really important that there be a space where people can access services, like on site, and not have to go all the way downtown, where, you know, many things can get in the way and offices are closed by the time you get there and so forth. So yeah, it's really smart to have a central spot where social services can be applied, because, you know, this, I assume that this is not supposed to be a permanent residence, but a temporary one, right?
For sure. And so this is really the intention here. What we see is, you know, these communities are nothing new. You know, we really haven't invented anything new or revolutionary. One of the first tiny home communities that was in Canada was called a Better Tent City. And so from where I am, it's just about back there. It's in Kitchener, Ontario, Better Tent City of Waterloo Region, and it's a community of 50 small tiny homes. Central services hub, and you know, the folks who live there are very high acuity individuals. So, a lot of folks who have, deep are in deep substance use, folks with acute physical and mental health challenges, and it was described by the phenomenal team who runs it. There's one person on the team who described it as a lifeboat in and as effective as a lifeboat can be. It keeps folks from dying in the street. It allows for a little bit of that kind of decompression of folks who have been stuck outside too long and having to navigate increasingly challenging circumstances. What we're looking to do basically is take that model to the city of Toronto, and attempt to kind of have that model work here. And the biggest difference is between Kitchener and Toronto for us is opportunities for land. So, in Kitchener, Ontario, they have a Better Tent City is built on a small plot of land that's a right of way for it's a road allowance between an industrial road and Highway 8, and it kind of continues onto the front lawn of the Kitchener School Board administrative offices. So it's a very funny little plot of land in a place that otherwise is reasonably low rise and compared to Toronto, not very dense. In Toronto, land is incredibly expensive. It's always said that there is really no space that hasn't already been earmarked for something or is in the process of being turned into something else. I think for us, one of the things that really makes this a little more innovative in the city of Toronto is that we are trying to use interim sites. We're making interim use of existing sites that will eventually be turned into something else and are currently sitting vacant with no use.
And I think you proposed this to the city of Toronto, and up until this past July, they had been saying, "Nah, we're not going to do that." Can you, and I saw you and your colleagues provide a series of presentations at a meeting, I think it was on July 9th, to the Economic Community and Development, no, the Economic
You got it right.
Development. Yeah, did I get it right? Okay. Economic Community Development Committee. A number of you presented on this. And at the end of that meeting, the City of Toronto, it looked like the needle actually did budge for once. They suggested something hopeful for this. Can you describe what their previous opposition was and what they suggested as a possible way forward?
For sure. So they, it's taken several years of kind of trying to warm the city up to this model, to kind of socialize them, if you will, to the idea of tiny home communities. And of course, there are, many questions. This is, I mean, for me as someone kind of with an architecture background, like this is an entirely new housing typology in the city of Toronto, right? This isn't something that's really been done before, and it's a large, bureaucratic government. And we also kind of fit somewhere in between, supportive housing and shelter. And these are actually run by different groups within the city. So it's a very siloed system. And so it took some time initially for us to figure out where we fit and who we were going to be speaking to about this. And ultimately, we've kind of taken the point of view that this is interim. This is not meant to be, clearly not meant to be permanent housing. It's not very dense, and the units don't have plumbing to keep costs down. And in order to be more transitional and move from place to place, and I'll talk about that in a moment. But we're looking for this to be this new model that's kind of somewhere between these two things. So it's taken some time for the city to start to warm up to the idea. Last summer, one of the city councilors, Councillor Moyes, put forth a motion asking Toronto Shelter and Support Services to do a study as to whether this is a feasible idea and something that's able to be brought to the city as an addition to the existing shelter system. And since then, Toronto Shelter and Support Services, they've been working towards this absolutely massive project of, building 20 new shelters, updating and replacing a lot of the existing shelters and shelter beds, adding a bit of new capacity to the system as well. And this is something that's going to happen over the next 10 years. Phenomenal, very necessary work that's being taken. And what we're basically proposing is kind of something in addition to that. So their hands are full and they have a lot on their plate. But at this year, at Economic and Community Development, Councillor Moyes asked for a kind of a status report on where that's going to be going. And what they came up with was that they said they're going to issue an expression of interest, so a request for potential proponents of tiny home communities to put forth a proposal that includes land, that includes an operator, includes a model, and it's a proposal for where and how and what they're going to build, that is what they call a micro shelter. So that's the city speak for tiny home community.
Right. And I think that they suggested something about maybe using unused TTC parking lots, which is interesting because I think you guys had in mind using land that was being set aside, like city land that was being set aside so it could be developed into shelters or affordable housing. And, inevitably there's 2 or 3 years where the plot of land will just be vacant before anybody actually starts digging into the ground. And they didn't seem too keen on that idea, but I was interested that they suggested TTC parking lots.
The idea here is that, what we've been proposing from the start is that development in the city of Toronto takes a very long time. In a past life, I've also kind of worked in the housing world, housing development world, to really understand what are these exact levers, how do they work, and how are we able to use them for good, and try to kind of navigate through them as quickly and efficiently as possible for what we want to do, and we know that it takes, 3 to 5 to 7 years of developing owning and developing a site before ground breaks, going through the permitting process, getting your site plan applications, your zoning bylaw amendments, official plan amendments if that's necessary, getting all of the costs lined up, getting all of the construction coordination lined up, designing the building. All of these things take a very long time. And in that time, often this public, like if it's city-owned land, this public land, which is intended for public use, sits empty, vacant with a fence around it, or it sits as a parking lot, which, arguably, and this may be a political statement, but I believe parking lots are lowest and worst use. We think to ourselves, we're in a housing crisis and we're in a homelessness crisis, and there are these empty sites that are sitting available, or at least sitting not really being used in ways that they could be, and certainly in areas where encampments exist. This is a problem that is not that this is a problem that already is in people's backyards, and so this is a situation where we're looking to create a better solution for an existing problem for a population that already exists all throughout the city. So what we've proposed from the very beginning is that we take advantage of that kind of 2 to 3 to 5 year, waiting period, during the development process while they're going through all the steps of getting a building ready so that ground can be broken, and place our community as a temporary use on that land until ground breaks. And then we pick everything up, we put them on flatbed trucks, and we send them off to the next site, and the process repeats. Part of that involves modularity of buildings. So the tiny homes we're looking at are, our prototype is about 8.5 feet wide. It fits just under the minimum requirements for kind of oversize sizes of structures that can be transported on Ontario roadways. So we don't need to have a special permit to put something on a flatbed and carry it. It fits within the boundaries that the government allows. The communal building that with all the services is a modular building that can be dismantled and moved in pieces. The idea here really is that we're able to take this land, we're able to take these spaces, make maximum use of them, help get people, decompress people, help pull them back to shore and get them ready so that when permanent housing is made available, and eventually as buildings slowly start to be built, folks who move into them won't be coming straight from encampments or straight from the shelter system where they're still kind of in the thick of it. They're able to decompress, they're able to, regain some of their skills, regain some of their just themselves, so that they're more successful in those houses.
Very cool. And I guess people will be curious, how much does it cost to build one of these houses?
Yeah, it's the big question. So each unit is about $25,000 we've got for each of our tiny homes. They've been built in other places for less money than that. Ours are built a little more sturdily. So we actually, because we're under the size requirements of Ontario Building Code, we don't have to, comply with every sort of specific requirement in there, but we do. And well beyond that, these units are designed to passive house standards, which means that they're very quiet, something very important for folks sleeping outside or have used the shelter system where you just can't get a good night's sleep. They've got like heat recovery ventilation units and air quality units that improve the air quality of the space. You can fit an air conditioner to the unit. They've got windows that allow at the front and back that allow a breeze, a flow through breeze. So, they're not stuffy. They're meant to be these lovely places to live, and they're meant to be durable enough that once, when someone's ready, if someone's able to move into permanent housing, that unit can be, lightly refurbished and is ready for the next person. And so you don't have to worry about, getting a new unit every time. It's kind of a one-time capital cost for the life of the unit. So 25,000 for the units, and then the rest of the site, if you divide it by the number of people on site, the communal building, all of the site services, works out to about another $25,000-ish per person. And then with site works, the whole community comes to about $3 million.
Okay, and SiteWorks, what is that?
Yeah, so that includes, whether there are garden beds on site, whether there's, any remediation that needs to be done on the site. If it's a, parking lot, it's making sure that it's nice and smooth and people aren't gonna, trip and fall when they're walking. All kind of the basic things that you need to bring any building or any piece of land to a place where folks can live on it.
So the $3 million sounds expensive, but how does that compare to providing housing per person in the shelter system?
For sure. So, the city's been working on modular housing recently, and so one unit of modular housing I remember being approximately $350,000, for a unit, and that may house one person or might house two people, but broadly speaking, like nine of those is about the same cost as about 50 of our units, and it's no shade on that. It's not to say that that's not also a necessary form of housing. That's a longer term form of housing. That's the type of thing folks from a program like this can graduate into. But we want to make sure that, folks are able to be supported truly as they are and as they need, and be ready to move into those things and succeed in them, and not, end up falling back out onto the street, coming back to encampments because they've lost their community in the process of gaining housing. And so that's really kind of where our model is meant to be, this transitional form of housing, both for the people using it and for the spaces that we occupy too.
I'm curious, have other big cities tried this model?
In Canada, this is the first time that we're really going to a large city. Los Angeles has kind of a version of this, way more tiny homes than we're planning to do. They have, a grid of dozens and dozens and dozens of them. I don't exactly recall the number, but my understanding was it was, closer to 100 than it is to 50. And so that model, sometimes has worked there, but we're cognizant of kind of the size of a community that, how many people are you able to know? How many people are you able to trust? A better tent city is a community of 50, and several of these types of communities are communities of about that size. So we're looking to, for the first time in particularly large urban setting, we're looking to kind of restrict that for an initial pilot to test the model, show that the model works, show the effect of what it is that we're doing, and then move upwards from there.
And so, if the city were to come back in the winter and say, okay, we think we're willing to do this pilot, where would the $3 million come from?
Right. So a combination of things. We've so far fundraised about $1 million as Two Steps Home. And so that money goes into the capital costs to build this community. We would be looking towards either some money from the municipal government, some other money, other funding sources like federal funding, CMHC funds, the Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation, for those who don't know, do a lot of grants and other, repayable loans and these sorts of things for projects like this. So we would want to go in with the city on something like that to secure the rest of those funds. And operating funds would come from the City of Toronto. So the same way that they fund their shelters, they would also be, funding this community for at the very least a set amount of time so that we can prove the success of the project.
I guess it's interesting because if you focus on people who are living in encampments who, in a sense, are not an expense to the city of Toronto, at least directly, indirectly they are, but not directly. This is asking the city to take on money to support people who they weren't supporting before, right? So, do you think that that investment would be recouped? Through the better transition of those people into housing in the longer term, or
For sure. And I think there's, you lead me to an interesting topic, which is I talked about, having a successful project and, what does success mean? And I think, in the shelter system, typically success is measured. Success is measured as, what's the flow through rate into permanent housing? How quickly can we get someone out of the system into permanent housing? And there are a couple of things there that maybe in our view miss the mark a little bit. The first one is that folks can go straight into permanent housing and not be able to function in this space. You're alone in a room in a building at the other end of the city and you don't know anybody around you, and the community that you relied on is no longer there, and you are not having a grand old time in that place. I think about there was a gentleman who I used to know in an encampment at Alexandra Park, and he was one of the kind of mayors of encampments. A little known fact, but most encampments have a mayor, and so he was the mayor of this encampment, so to speak. Although I don't think he would admit it, but he basically held that role. And when the city a couple of years back, you may remember in June, July of 2021, did massive clearings of several encampments, Trinity Bellwoods, Alexandra Park, and Lamport Stadium. And in the process of doing that, before that happened, this gentleman was given a spot in permanent housing, and he had lived on the street for about 4 years prior to that. So he had lived in encampments, was doing his thing. Wasn't willing to go into the shelter system, or had negative experiences, and therefore wasn't willing. And he lived in his apartment about 2 months and passed away from an overdose, alone in his apartment. And I remember for me, that was the moment when I realized, okay, the solution, getting people to permanent housing as quickly as possible works for some people, but that cannot be said to be a successful solution. Pushing people into permanent housing, if that's the measure of success that the city uses. But very clearly, that was not a successful moment for this man. And so what we're really looking to do is still show that there's outflow and that there's success into that, because that is the metric that the city uses, but also make sure that we have other metrics of success that we're able to show for. So those are things like reductions in EMS calls. Reductions in hospitalizations, reductions in police calls. That's a big one. That there's a community in Peterborough, the Modular Bridge housing community run by the Elizabeth Fry Society, and absolutely phenomenal group. Very similar project to what we're proposing to do here. They saw a 96% drop in police calls to their area from before the community was there, when it was an encampment, and after the community was there, and folks were living there. And that's their staff to deal with things on site. You know, folks are in not quite as a heightened estate because you have your own little space and you're still in community. And situations are able to be worked out in often a much less intense way and a much less costly way. So one of the things we'll want to be able to do is show, you know, those reductions, or at least be able to lean on the fact that folks aren't staying in the shelter system. They're staying in encampments, and the city's, you know, not paying those costs. But there are a lot of other costs kind of to the side that are still dealt with, that we're looking to not have to deal with here.
Yeah, because the encampments are incredibly unpopular, right? And they cost local residents access to their parks, you know, which may be an intangible cost, but local residents certainly anticipate that their property values go down when they have encampments nearby. So hopefully, if those encampments were to leave and be transformed into tiny home places or, you know, communities, then this would be a win-win for everybody. So, well, and when do you expect to get word from the city about what the next steps will be for Two Steps?
So we're at the point right now where we're actively, you know, looking for land, whether that's land that's municipally owned, whether that's land that's owned by, you know, other social organizations or other, you know, large landowners in the city. That can be public, that can be private. Each one of them comes kind of with its own, you know, with its own challenges to navigate, with its own incentivizational techniques, you know, that we may be able to do to kind of make it possible to get this project off the ground. You know, thinking about like a for-profit developer, naturally they're going to be worried that this project will, you know, delay their construction, which will cost their investors, which prevents them from building a building. So, you know, naturally they're going to be a little bit hesitant. Proving that we're able to leave the site after a certain period of time is a way to help mitigate that concern. And those types of concerns we're going to be doing for each group who we go and talk to. And the goal is to respond to this expression of interest with a proposal for a site and get things going.
Well, that's very exciting, and I hope that you know, this time next year you'll be able to point to a place which is, you know, all ready to receive the tiny cabins. So,
I hope so too. I hope so too, Matt. That could be parking lots. That could be anywhere.
well, thank you very much for sharing your time and your background on this today. It's, you know, the homelessness issue has been around for so long, and there seem to be so few new ideas on the table. So it's really nice to hear a new one.
Well, thank you. Yeah, all ideas are necessary, and you know, I don't think any one is necessarily, you know, worse than another, but we need everything we have at hand to see this project through. So thank you so much for having me. It's really nice to chat.
My pleasure. And if people want to learn more about the Two Steps Home, where should they go? Is there a website that they can visit?
There is, so they can visit www.twostepshome.com, TWO. They can see us on social media at Two Steps Home, also TWO. And our email address and whatnot can be found on our website there too.
Terrific. Well, good luck. And I hope that, one day Toronto will be able to see a bunch of tiny cabins, and a lot of what was it? The former vice president once referred to people as happy campers. Hopefully, people who leave encampments who are very happy to be in their tiny cabins, a place that they can call their own for a while.
100%.
All
Yeah.
right. Take care. Thank you.
Thank you for having me, Reverend.
That was an interview with Robert Rayner from Two Steps Home. If you'd like to learn more about Two Steps Home, please visit their website. And they will hopefully be in the news in the next few months and certainly the next year as the City of Toronto considers adopting their proposal for creating a few of these two-step homes communities in Toronto on underused land. Thank you for listening. And if you would like to learn more about our church, we're Lawrence Park Community Church. We're a United, part of the United Church of Canada, and we're located in Toronto, Canada. If you'd like to see some of our YouTube videos, please go to YouTube and just search for the name of our church, Lawrence Park Community Church. And if you'd like to visit us on the web to see what sorts of things we do on Sunday mornings and the rest of the week, you can visit our website at www.lawrenceparkchurch.ca. Until the next time we meet, God bless and peace be with you. Thank you.